Look at us go. Look at us go.
Gold stars for both of us.
We are here again.
I know. I don't think anyone is more surprised than us that we're actually keeping a pace this season, especially because the interview, we have an interview for today, and we'll have an interview coming up with two incredible women who we interviewed actually like almost a year ago. So this is ridiculous mm-hmm. that it's taken us this long to get our act together, but we've both had a bunch of family stuff happen the last year. Like, there's just been a lot going on. So we didn't want to play those episodes and then not be able to follow through with the rest of the season. And so this right now, we have momentum, we have wind beneath our wings, wind behind our sails. I don't know. What is the saying?
Yeah, I mean, both. We have the wind is beneath our wings. It's in our sails. It's up other places. I don't know.
Here we go. But we listened to these episodes. I was so just, again, in awe of both of the women we've interviewed. We'll focus on one today. And hopefully we'll roll out the other one very soon. But today we're going to play an interview we did with Leah Slick Driscoll, who is a teacher in Iowa. We'll say a little bit more about her. She'll say a little bit more about herself. But Leah and I met several years ago, and it's one of those meetings that like immediately thought, oh, I'm so excited to get to know this person better. And I just meeting someone you know you're going to be connected to and just that you were meant to meet. And I've just been so grateful for her friendship, for what she has taught me, what she teaches her students, just her professional life, her personal life. She's just an incredible, incredible person. And I'm really, really grateful to have crossed paths with her and to call her a friend. So I was really excited that she was willing to talk to us. Yeah.
Yeah. And the same with all of the guests that we've had, but just the openness mm-hmm. to talk to us, the kindness they're extending to us as white women to like spend their time and energy to, you know, help discuss more of these issues and hopefully educate more people. I'm always really, really grateful for that. And she was amazing.
Like yes.
all of our guests have been. So I'm excited for everyone to finally hear this episode.
Yes. Leah, just for a little bit of background, and we'll get into this in the conversation you're about to listen to, but she is a member of the Meskwaki Nation of Iowa and also Winnebago from Nebraska. I mentioned she's a teacher at the Meskwaki Settlement School. She's been there for many years, I think since maybe 2009, and teaches high school, including Indigenous Studies, U.S. history. She received her bachelor's degree in history and social studies education from the University of Iowa and her master's degree in social studies education also from the University of Iowa. She does a ton of work in the state and beyond. We will link in the show notes to a document that I found incredibly helpful as an educator, which was a statement with others across the country, other Native scholars, other scholars who are focused on Indigenous education, but it's a statement for affirming and respecting Indigenous peoples and nations as we teach social studies, which we've been talking about some of the laws that are being passed, some of the legislation that goes directly against everything in this statement. So it's absolutely worth reading. Incredible people contributed to it, including Leah. So we're really excited to listen to this conversation. Anything you would want listeners to take note of or maybe go into this conversation thinking about?
I mean, both of us grew up in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And I think part of what I took away from it is, even though this is a person and a people that are, you know, occupied the land that we grew up in, obviously way before any of our ancestors got there. Mm-hmm. And that I still knew so little about it, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. had no education about it in any of our public schooling. You know, we grew up right next to their settlement that they still have. It's kind of mind boggling. And I'm sure that that's the case for Indigenous peoples of everywhere in this country. So just a reminder to be sure that we're looking into that and know where you live and whose land that you're on. And that's really important to know that history, because our history as colonizers has been to erase that, and we did a good job of it. Like, it is not very easy to get information on if you're looking, you know, in the, your standard, you know, white education, American education system. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing I took away from her the most was like her love for her people and her desire to see them still be around and how much she puts into it. And especially like the Meskwaki children and how much she cares that they still have their people, their language, their land, and that that does not disappear in the next several generations, because it has come so close to being completely gone so many times. So I think
relationship too between culture, language, religion, land, family, kinship, you know, nationhood, all of that. And to your point, you know, if you aren't a person who is Indigenous or an enrolled member of a nation, or, you know, someone with that family connection and that community, that that citizenship, that nationhood, then it is something you have to actively seek, because that erasure has been really effective in public schools, you know, just in media representations. I think Leah talks really powerfully about that, just the messaging that non-Native people get about Native communities, Native sovereignty. And so just if you are listening and you are someone who is not Native, then push yourself, challenge yourself. You know, what can you learn about the people, the land, the culture, the sovereignty issues that are ongoing? You know, these aren't histories of the past. Of course, they're connected to things that happened in the past, but these are ongoing current issues, and really pushing ourselves, challenging ourselves to know as much as we can about that, to be in relationship with those communities, and to be part of movements, part of efforts to recognize sovereignty, to uphold treaties, to be good neighbors, be good siblings in this world. So I think in some ways this interview is like really anchoring us as two white women who grew up in this place, hopefully inspiring others to look into where they're from, where they are, and those histories and current issues and communities that need us to not be shitty, basically. Well, enjoy the conversation, everyone.
Welcome, Leah. We're so happy to have you today. Katie and I did a little introduction, but we would love to have you kind of introduce yourself and let us know what you would like people to know about you.
I mean, I'm obviously a teacher of middle school and high school students. I'm a foster and adoptive mother, and I have 7 children, 3 birth children and 4 adoptive children that were, you know, by birth, my nephews and niece. I have an amazing husband who is non-Native, and we have been married for about 26 years.
Oh my God.
Wow. And it's very important to us to raise our children in the Meskwaki community so that they have access to their culture, language, and religion, as well as the school. And I think the other thing that it would be important for people to know is that because we are a tribally controlled Bureau of Indian Education school, we don't have to follow the critical race, you know, policies of the state of Iowa. And so that is, you know, amazing. Sometimes I say to my students, this could truly be the only classroom in Iowa where people are allowed to learn, you know, the things that we're learning today.
Yeah.
So
that just gives me goosebumps. That makes me so grateful for you all, but also just so infuriated.
Yeah, it makes me sad for other students who are experiencing something very different.
Yep. Well, let's start with that. So talk a little bit about the Meskwaki Settlement School, where you are a teacher, and maybe just even give us a little bit of history about the school and why it is so unique and special. You know, you've mentioned that because it is, well, I guess explain like its governance structure. So why it doesn't have to follow the state legislature's laws about what can and can't be taught right now. So I think it just is such a unique school, even in the country, a unique place. Just give us a little background about where you teach.
So the Meskwaki Settlement School is a Bureau of Indian Education school. So it's under federal authority, but we are tribally controlled. through our tribal council and the Meskwaki people that serve on our school board. And our mission statement specifically states that we are here to preserve language, culture, history of the Meskwaki people. And certainly part of that mission statement, in order to understand Meskwaki history, it would be to understand, you know, American history as a whole, as well as the histories of other indigenous peoples in the Americas and around the world. So we certainly, you know, teach American history, but we have a very definite mission to also teach Meskwaki history mm-hmm. and current events.
And how long have you been teaching at the school?
15 years.
And is it K through 12?
It's actually, we have a three-year-old language nest. So pre-K students come to our school and they are taught in Meskwaki.
Wow.
So that they can develop those early Meskwaki language skills. And then we have language TAs in every classroom in the elementary school that can, you know, help the teachers that are non-Meskwaki, who maybe don't have a lot of experience with the Meskwaki language, to make sure that that language is also spoken in the classroom.
Even just right there, like that piece of it is so powerful and important and connected to the histories that we're going to dive into this season. Like, why? That is incredibly powerful to have that language as part of early childhood education. Can you talk a little bit about Meskwaki history in terms of preserving language and even just the Meskwaki history with its relationship to the land? Because that is also such a unique part of Native history in the United States. Yeah.
Sure. Well, I think any indigenous group of people in the world, their culture, their religion, their language is shaped by their connection to the land and what their environment is like. And, you know, that is where the culture grows from. Mm-hmm. And the two cannot exist without each other. And so if you look at Meskwaki history, we have always lived in forested, heavily forested areas. And, you know, if you look at our journey over thousands of years, you know, our ancestral past would have been somewhere in Southeast Canada or possibly like the area of Maine and Massachusetts. Mm. And that would be thousands of years ago. And then over time, you know, as long as we are living in a deeply forested area, that is an environment we're familiar with. Mm. As long as it has that rich black soil for us to grow our crops that are our ancestral crops. And so we traveled over time and we've lived in, you know, some different locations over the past thousands of years, Michigan and Wisconsin. And then in the 1700s, we moved down into Iowa. After the Fox Wars, a fight with the French over our lands around the Green Bay area. And we have been here, you know, living in the eastern half of Iowa, which was a swampy and heavily forested, you know, portion of the state. It's always very surprising to me when people characterize Iowa as the Great Plains, because eastern Iowa, when you let the land go back to its natural state, mm-hmm. or you leave it alone and it's in its natural state, it looks like Backbone State Park. Mm-hmm. It looks like Lake McBride. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a very moisture-rich area. We don't have irrigation systems in eastern Iowa in our fields because we don't need them. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of water here. And where there's plenty of water, trees are going to grow. Mm-hmm. And that's how we know that eastern Iowa was forested. The other reason we know that it was forested is because we wouldn't have lived here mm-hmm. if it were the Great Plains. That is a foreign environment to us. We plant corn, beans, and squash, and you can't easily plant those crops on the Great Plains. They won't grow there. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. this is, you know, this is definitely our environment. And if you look at the Meskwaki settlement on a map, what you see is plowed fields all around and then this huge band of forest. And, you know, this is just such a beautiful place to live. And it's basically what our ancestors were dreaming of for us. When we returned to Iowa, we had to replant a lot of trees because it had already been, you know, cleared by people who had claimed and used the land while we were gone and while we were in removal. Mm-hmm. So we were removed from Iowa in 1845 and placed on the Osage River Reservation in Kansas for 12 years. And 75% of all Meskwakis died there. Of the 1,400 that left, only just a little bit over 300 returned. And there were roughly 100 Meskwakis that never left Iowa and that were always kind of like hiding out in the forest areas along the Iowa River and trying to pave a way for us, for the rest of the tribe to come back and purchase this, repurchase a piece of our own land that had been, you know, taken in the treaties. So we purchased the settlement in 1857 for $1,000, and it was the original 80 acres. And from there, you know, over time, as we have had financial resources, we try to purchase, you know, more and more land and to grow our land base. Because still, if you look at the tribal nations of the United States, we have 4% of our original lands that we would have had in the year, you know, 1600, for instance. You know, the entire what is now called the United States would have been indigenous lands. And today, natives have roughly 4%. Mm-hmm. And so even among other native nations, to have roughly 10,000 acres of land, that is a very small land base. I mean, there are some Iowa farmers that have that much land just mm-hmm. on the farm. Mm-hmm. So it kind of shows you, you know, what happened to just dispossess natives of their lands over time and how it would be difficult for an entire tribal nation to live sustainably on their indigenous foods with such a small land base.
I think one of the tragedies that we talk about in how we teach about indigenous peoples in schools is that it's taught as if it's something that was just in the past, like almost like they don't exist today. And I think that's one of the things that I was reading that, you know, you tried to address in your teaching. So what is the Meskwaki population today? Are they mainly in Iowa, like the numbers wise? And how is that settlement established?
You know, Meskwaki people experienced two genocidal events. You know, in the 1730s, we went from a population in which there were 20,000 people trading and living in the Grand Village of the Meskwaki in Wisconsin. And maybe not all of them were Meskwakis at that point, but most of them were, down to a population of 300 people by 1734, after a 30-year war with the French. And then we built our population back up again. And then removal happened. And again, we lost 75% of our population to sickness, you know, starvation, just living in the elements and not being able to grow our crops in sod type soil in Kansas that's extremely dry, you know, basically verging on Oklahoma and, you know, New Mexican lands. And so when we returned, you know, so many Meskwakis had died from epidemic illnesses and from that, the harsh conditions of that removal experience. And so building our population back up, I would say, you know, today we have 1,400 enrolled members, but I would say that there are probably somewhere around 3,000 Meskwaki people, you know, total.
Well, and the percentages are really high in terms of who speaks Meskwaki, right?
Right. Compared to many other tribal nations, the one thing that characterizes Meskwaki people as different is that we didn't, because we purchased our own piece of land in Iowa at great cost, you know, saving that money meant eating half rations, and it meant more Meskwakis died during that removal period. But saving that money allowed us to purchase a piece of land as private owners at the time. And so when the federal government came to us and said, okay, it's your turn to go to boarding school, basically Meskwakis could refuse because we were living on land that we purchased. It's not a reservation. It's a settlement. Mm-hmm. And they threatened all kinds of things. You know, we threatened to take away annuities, threatened to take away, you know, any type of assistance with food. And still Meskwaki said, you know, we have heard what's happening in other tribes. We know what happened to all those tribes that went to Oklahoma. The moment those tribes arrived in these lands, there was a white agent who was going to oversee their lands that they were assigned. There was a school and there was a church, and they forced people to go to those two places, or they would cut off their rations, or they would simply load the kids into train cars, you know, using the military or the police, and take them to boarding school. And so at boarding school, you are assigned a new English name. Your hair is cut. All of your clothing that you came with, including your sacred items like your tobacco or your cedar or whatever you're using to pray with, that is all taken and burnt in a common bonfire that night. Mm. And then kids are given all the same clothing. And though they may speak little or no English, they would force them, or they would choose for them, new Anglo names. And sometimes, you know, boarding school leaders would choose names that they found ironic or funny, like naming somebody Andrew Jackson, or, you know, things like that, Thomas Jefferson. You know, the people that are directing the genocide.
It just
against
makes me like so sick. Like, what kind of person's like, it's so gross. Sorry to interrupt, but yeah. that is really disturbing.
Right. And I mean, I guess it's, there are so many things that you can line up with other genocides that have happened in the world. Mm. And many Americans don't view this or realize that it isn't. It's one of the longest sustained genocides in human history. Mm-hmm. Our genocide, especially cultural genocide, has been going on from the moment that white settlers landed on the East Coast and gained the upper hand in population, and then systematically began going off after each and every tribe. And then once they had control of the lands and had Native people confined to an assigned reservation, then they immediately started going after the next problem and the real problem, and that is identity. Mm-hmm. How do we take Native people, if we're not going to exterminate every last one of them, how do we take the remaining 2% of Native people and make sure that they are like us? Because we can't handle the fact that they want to retain their own culture, language, and religion. Mm-hmm. The only way we're comfortable living on the same continent as them is if they are like us, mm-hmm. in language, in religion, in the way that they are going to live. And that really did mean attempting to change every aspect of the culture. And today we know that that is not just merely assimilation, that is cultural genocide, with the stated goal of eliminating Native culture, period. Mm. And that, with some tribes, the level of control they had over their children and over their ability to even remain alive, you know, when you threaten people's food source, mm-hmm. and they can't grow their own crops, and you are dropping off rations of bacon, flour, baking soda, salt, tea, and coffee, and this is what they have to eat, and you're saying you're even going to cut that off if you don't send, you know, your children and your families to church and to school, then that is, you know, you have a choice between staying alive or, you know, can I teach my child quietly at home until they're actually taken away to boarding school at a completely different location? Mm-hmm. That is what was happening earlier on the reservations. And that is something that Meskwaki people largely escaped. They did try to, they built a boarding school in Toledo, Iowa, about 5 miles away from us. And around the turn of the century in 1900, they tried to force Meskwaki's children to go to that school. And the Meskwaki tribe refused. And there was actually a court case in which a girl who was of marriageable age back then, you know, somewhere around 16 or 17, was being forced, they were trying to force her to go to the boarding school. And she was saying, no, I'm an adult. Like, I'm not going to this school. Mm-hmm. And so the court case was actually decided in her favor. Mm-hmm. And the court ruled that she didn't have to go to the school. And so very few Meskwakis ever attended the school. Those who did attended, you know, voluntarily, like, let's just see what's going to happen if I go here. What's this going to be like? Mm-hmm. And so they ended up having to bus in other Native nations who they could force to go, such as the Omahas in Nebraska, you know, the Ojibways in Minnesota, and you know, other tribes. So other tribes' children went there for the few short years that it was actually open as a boarding school. And then they kind of realized, you know, the lack of success of it. And around the turn of the century, when smallpox and tuberculosis were on the rise, especially tuberculosis, they turned it into a sanitarium to send Native people that needed to be quarantined. And it became a sanitarium for tuberculosis patients. Mm. And then eventually it later became a button factory and is now called the Plantation Apartments because it is faintly reminiscent of like a white plantation house.
The layers of that are bananas.
Right. But that is why, you know, Meskwaki people retained Meskwaki as their first language, I would say up until the 1970s, most people who are age 50 or 55 and above, you know, understand Meskwaki completely and can speak pretty fluently. And then people under that age, there's a huge divide because the public school systems were preaching to parents, if you want your children to be able to get a job, if you want your children to be able to, you know, compete in the world outside of the settlement, they need to have a firm grasp of English and to get, you know, an Americanized education. And before the Meskwaki settlement school was even built, our students were, you know, getting bused to South Tama schools, which were, you know, 4 or 5 miles away. And in schools in Iowa and in around the country, you know, the schools are giving this message to parents. If you teach and speak to your children in their native language, that's going to be a disadvantage to them. And so many families stopped speaking this all the time with their young children. And so there's a whole like gap in the generations where, you know, people in their 40s, 30s, and 20s now do not have Meskwaki as their first language. You know, educational research shows us today that students who learn two or more languages side by side will eventually sort that out for themselves by age 6 and will be able to categorize, okay, this is Meskwaki, this is English, or this is Spanish. But unfortunately, that theory, you know, and especially with the push of the schools, seeing Meskwaki culture as inferior and Meskwaki language as a barrier to success, it really created a devastating breach in who can speak Meskwaki fluently and who cannot. We definitely have adult language learner classes where I think we're up to maybe, I would have to check, level 12 or 15, where you basically take classes for 10 or 12 weeks. And you are learning the language as an adult and speaking it with other adult learners. And then when you test that you are proficient in that level, you move up. And so that is the really amazing and inspiring thing about, you know, those Meskwaki language learners that are all the way up to level 10, 12, you know, 13. You know, this is, we know that people can become fluent in a native language if they are determined and they are practicing and speaking all the time. But our best, you know, our best focus is to really make sure that every single student at this school has that access to language from you know, hopefully as early as possible. We are opening a new childcare center. We're building a brand new wellness center, recreation center. And in that center, there will be childcare. And so if we have fluent Meskwaki speakers working as the childcare providers, we could literally have newborn babies, you know, and one-year-olds with access to the language every day. And that is going to make such a huge impact. You know, hopefully they will never have to go through the angst of, you know, I feel this deficit or this loss that I didn't have access to that as my first language, because that is so important to Native people as a part of their identity and keeping their culture and religion going, to be able to speak their language.
Are there other Indigenous groups that have settlements like the Meskwaki, or is that really unique to the Meskwaki people?
We are the only tribe in the 1800s that purchased land in this way that I'm aware of, but I really couldn't answer that question without doing more research. To my knowledge, there have been some tribes that have purchased land in the 21st century and maybe even currently, but I think it's a pretty unique status. If there are other tribes, it would be very few. Most tribes, if you look at the map of federally designated native lands, are labeled as reservations or reserves.
Right. Well, I'm just thinking, I mean, this is just case in point that Katie and I both grew up and were educated in Iowa schools and never learned any of this that I remember, which my memory's bad, but I don't think it's me this time.
Well, and Mandy went to college at Grinnell for undergrad, which is close to the settlement too. So just the proximity, it's something that I just keep wrestling with. When I was a professor, a lot of my students, I worked at Iowa State University, which is also not very far from the settlement. And I would have students who came from Tama, which is the nearest town, Iowa town. Mm-hmm. And they had no idea. And it was like within a couple of miles. And so I think that's part of this that is so, I don't even know if there's like a word that bundles up all of the emotions and like
erasure.
It's like, yes. It's like, actually, I don't mean this in like a congratulatory way when I say impressive, but like that is bonkers that you can have people living in that close of proximity and one group has absolutely no idea that they're participating in the ongoing settler colonialism and oppression, like that they have absolutely, it's like they have to know. I say we have to know on some level, but to know that because of that erasure, because of all of these ways, like whether it's misrepresentation or just complete erasure, that makes it so invisible. And that when it is visible, there are all of these stories told to justify what you're seeing. It's like, when I say impressive, I just mean like the scale of ignorance that it takes to continue and perpetuate among non-Native people is really staggering and infuriating. It's not even a question. I guess I'm just like putting, like, I'm sure this isn't a super unusual experience for non-Native people to have, that they live in a place and it never occurs to them to even ask questions or to learn about. And they certainly don't get it in their K-12 education. They unlikely get it in their university education. Like, what do you see as helpful that breaks through that like bubble of ignorance that settler colonialism depends so much on?
Well, it's not even ignorance, because there is a certain level of simple denial and like maybe colonial guilt, because you cannot, I don't care how determined you are, if you're reading an American history book on quote unquote westward expansion, you are reading about this, and it's so important in these history books to portray Native people as having no technology, no real culture, no real religion, to portray them as murderous, you know, treacherous people who just want to attack other people and kill them, and to perpetuate that in the modern day with movies and stereotypical depictions. So in my Indigenous studies class that I teach, we look at media representations of Natives. And when you look up the top 10 like Western movies as rated by, you know, movie critics and people who love Westerns, John Wayne's The Searchers often comes up in the top 3. The Library of Congress has labeled this as culturally significant for every American to see and experience. And it's one of the worst portrayals of Native people on film. Mm. It really feels like it's almost an act of cultural genocide in and of itself. Basically, they, you know, set up this situation in which this white man who's in red face as like the chief of, you know, these Comanches is out, you know, to murder innocent American settlers. And, you know, there's acts of violence committed against Native women in the film that are meant to be, you know, moments of laughter and comedy. And there are, you know, they're opening up a grave and shooting somebody, you know, in the face a couple of times to prevent them from getting to the afterlife and all of this other stuff. There's just horrific things happening in this movie. And the fact that in 2020, it was number one on the list of best Westerns just shows us that this type of media representation feeds into and supports not only a denial, but an active portrayal of Native people as undeserving of their lands, their resources, or even the label of human. These things are not old representations. They are, go to any Atlanta Braves game and see the way that Native men are portrayed with these little foam tomahawks and the supposed Indian song that they're singing, you know, every time they want their team to score or celebrating something. So there are very real modern day efforts to keep it the way that it is.
Yeah.
The way that things are going in many parts of the country with like just basically scrubbing history of anything that would potentially make white people feel bad. is there, do you have any ideas? Do you have any hope that there is some way to like bring this education back into schools? I mean, not back into it. It was never there correctly in the first place, or to introduce it just on an actual community level.
I mean, I think when you think of the American population by 2040 being so diverse that every single American there will no longer be a majority racial category any longer. You have to ask yourself, what are you preparing your children for? Because they will live in a world that is extremely diverse. Will they be employable? Will they be able to interact with other people in a positive and meaningful way? And there's no way that there's any incentive to participate in democracy. If democracy's always been on autopilot, you don't have to participate, and to challenge it is useless, is a waste of time. If you don't have to pay attention because everything's fine and has always been fine for you as a white person, then the problem becomes, what happens when you're not the majority any longer? Do people of color have ways of, you know, getting their stories out there, getting their histories out there? Do they have a way of interacting in positive ways as American citizens and changing laws? Or does it have to come to something darker, you know, to rectify the current situation? So if you really want to teach about democracy to students, you have to teach that mistakes were made in the past. And when we don't pay attention and when we don't acknowledge to, you know, these things, they continue and they're perpetuated. And then you can either deal with it in a democratic way, or you can deal with it in something like the Civil War. So I don't, you know, with the modern day technology and society that we are today, I don't think any person on earth wants to see that.
Right.
You know, war on that level again. So what we have to do, and the only hope for a truly democratic America when there is no longer a majority group of people, is to make sure that we educate our children in historical truths, acknowledge, build bonds, pave a positive way forward where all people truly are equal. And you can't have equality if history is still lying about your story.
Right.
You can't heal and move on
right.
as a person who's experienced things and that you're still struggling with as a community if it's deny, deny, deny.
Yeah, at that point, like that, just even pushing, like acknowledging it is such a baseline. Like that's not even getting into like the healing and reparations and land back and like what it would actually take to make something whole and right. And, you know, that's what's, I think maybe overwhelming is the wrong word, but it just like that knowing that that's the fight right now is at the level of acknowledgement when there is another 72 hills to climb before we can even come close to like healing and being a real community of care and concern, you know, that's what's just stunning that in an era where we have access to so much information and there really is no reason that we should be arguing about this like acknowledgement level. That is just kind of stunning, I think.
Sure. But
again, not a question. It's me just being frustrated today. Just poor Leah. Just well, actually, hear me back.
One of my good friends who is a professor and she teaches in Oregon. She's originally from California. She recently shared a slide at a training and it was a list of questions that you either answered yes or no to. And there were three Indigenous people in the room and there were 25, you know, white people in the room. And so I'll just kind of read the list. I don't have to worry that images, symbols, and names of people of my ethnicity will be used as sports mascots, Halloween costumes, or marketing logos. Question two, I'm relatively confident that when I die, my language will not die with me. Number three, I'm not burdened that people will appropriate and bastardize the spirituality and religion that is meant to be specific to my community. Number four, I can see myself and my ethnic group represented in a wide variety of media and popular culture that are not predominantly stereotypes. I am, and my entire ethnic group is, usually represented in statistical findings in studies and reports. I am never confronted with comments that express surprise that my group is still living. I'm never confronted with comments that imply that my group is primitive, warlike, and in need of another group's influence. I've never had to defend against the desecration or unearthing of the burials of my ancestors. I am not a subject to a legal system that is based on the concept of cultural and religious inferiority of my group. My group is not spoken of in derisive terms in the U.S. founding documents. I've never had to worry that the legal existence of my group could be terminated by the U.S. government at any time. I have no ancestors who were considered wards of the state, even though they committed no crime. I have no ancestors that were hunted for bounties paid for by any governmental agency. These are all things that, you know, white Americans can go down the list and say no to. Mm-hmm. Whereas every Indigenous person, you know, we could add more to the list, such as the involuntary sterilizations of the 1960s and 70s that happened to Native women all over Indian Health Service hospitals. They started to try to gather statistics and numbers first in the Southwest Indian Health Service hospitals. But after they found, you know, so many involuntary sterilizations, they kind of like had to shut that down because what did that mean if they found it in every single hospital, you know, across the nation? And it's estimated that 30 to 40% of all Native women were sterilized in the 60s and 70s to try to control the population. And we know that that was done to Black women and Hispanic women and is still being done in certain parts of the world that are labeled as developing nations where they don't, you know, certain organizations are paying for quinacrine and other drugs to get this done. You know, it kind of checks people on their privilege that they get to wake up and not think about any of those things today. Like, will my religion survive another generation? Our traditional religion, will our language survive another generation? Will how many students from this graduating class will, you know, be okay 10 years from now and will not be a statistic, you know, a person that passed away from substance or, you know, a car accident or, you know, violence. So we know that Native women have the highest rates of sexual violence in the United States, period, hands down. And so all of these things are things that Native people have to contend with.
Something we talk a lot about here is, you know, it's easy sometimes to look at people on the right or the far right who are like really flagrantly, openly advocating for policies of extermination, genocide, et cetera, you know. But I think the group that we're more interested in are especially white women who identify more with like liberal or progressive politics, but who do so much harm and damage in that sphere. And so thinking about your example of someone coming up, like that's just a, such a common thing to like work through guilt, you know, to, by proximity to say like, oh, well, look at all the baskets I got on my last vacation, you know, and how like I do this or do that, like the kind of the not even kind of just absolutely still problematic, harmful ways that that white women, I will speak about us, are like stumbling towards trying to unlearn or do something different. So when you, I mean, this is a huge question to ask you too, but there, like, what are those other pitfalls or common harmful things that that people, that non-Native people, I guess not necessarily just white people, but, you know, white people are definitely like the engines of settler colonialism. What are the things that they're doing sort of in the name of more liberal or progressive actions, policies that still suck, basically, that we should be super aware of as we're unlearning ourselves and doing more education?
One of the biggest things that, and I think, again, Meskwakis have their traditional religion intact. Whereas when you go to most other Native nations, they, you know, faced such extreme assimilation in the boarding schools and even just back on the reservation with the, you know, being forced to go to church, is that, you know, Christianity is either blended in with their traditional religion or they don't have, you know, their traditional religion in a lot of communities. It's been completely erased. And so, you know, a lot of people will come up to me and say, the Lakota people, you know, they cherish their traditional religion and many people in their tribe still practice their traditional religion. And so when I hear, you know, we know that statistically they are struggling with poverty at a much higher rate than even head and shoulders among, you know, Native nations. And so when I hear that like missionary groups or church groups are traveling to Pine Ridge or Rosebud or whatever, and, you know, oh, I, you know, a lot of people will come up and say, oh, I traveled to Pine Ridge when I was a kid and did some service work there. And I'm like, oh, really? Well, like, what type of volunteer organization was it? And they're like, oh, it was with my youth group, my church group. We brought things, you know, to give them, and we, you know, brought food donations and stuff like that. And there's always this question in my mind. And that question is, does it come with a price tag? Like, do you really call that volunteerism when it's an attempt to promote, you know, your religion, and you want them to convert to your religion, and you're, you know, giving these things with that question mark, you know, maybe they are, you know, being, it's just complete volunteerism and there's no pressure to convert or pressure to, but it just feels that way in my mind. It kind of, it's almost like, oh yeah, but at what cost? So that is, you know, people would genuinely think I'm doing a great thing by bringing all of this stuff that they desperately need. But is there an ulterior motive or a price tag, you know, attached to that where they have to, you know, appear to, or they have to, you know, appear to support your agenda in order to, you know, get these items or this volunteer service? So that is one thing that, you know, people would say, oh, I'm a great person and I do this all the time. I mean, really, it's like, it's a constant bombardment in some cases of all of these stereotypes that are really just outdated. And if you were really interested in Native people and interacting with them, it's not Native people's job to constantly educate the non-Native public about our history. It's not a requirement for us to share our culture and religion with people. Mm. And there are some questions that they would never ask another group of people, but they feel entitled to ask Native people. And it kind of makes you look, you know, it makes you feel like you're walking into a room of people and you're just wondering, what are they thinking about me? Mm-hmm. Like, what stereotypes are they waiting to like inflict upon me and like ask me about that makes me feel like I'm an animal in a zoo that is so strange to them, you know, just othering people constantly. And, you know, our Native youth, as they travel around Iowa playing sports, they're, you know, the children are constantly saying racist things to them, especially in communities that are 99% white. Mm-hmm. What can women do if their school is not willing to educate their children? They can do their part at home with their families and their children. Mm-hmm. And it's not about being tolerant of other people.
Right.
It's about embracing other people and embracing differences. I don't teach my children to dislike people who have a different religion. In fact, I'm teaching my children to be anti-racist. It's an actual, it's an on-purpose effort to teach them to be anti-racist and to be anti-discriminatory. And, you know, I am proud of my children and they are, you know, working in the fields of psychology and law and, you know, they're pursuing their advanced degrees in these areas. And that is the thing that I am proudest of them for, that they have these open minds and open hearts for other people and that they view other people's differences as, you know, that's what's beautiful about the world. When you travel to Japan or when you travel to New Zealand or, you know, Libya, you know, if everything in that country was exactly the same as America, as a white Christian America, there would be no reason to travel there. The reason you're traveling there is because this is a whole new world with new foods and new languages and new worldviews and new religions and new environments. And that's what's beautiful and exciting about the world. It's not about making us all the same. And that's what is so hard to so hard for schools to teach if they can't teach a true history or a diverse history. Mm-hmm. How can your children ever appreciate other people if that, you know, they're learning what Governor Reynolds wants them to learn in that classroom?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's no incentive for them to participate in democracy if America has never made a mistake. Mm-hmm. Because America's been doing fine on autopilot all these years, supposedly. So why would they get out of the armchair and go vote or stand up for anything or stand against something?
It makes me think, too, about the reluctance to investigate or interrogate what history you're actually closest to. So, like, how many of us, like my great-great-great-grandparents came to Iowa and covered wagons. And what do I know about what they participated in and benefited from? And like, if I'm going to get close to history, that is actually, I think, a more powerful, but it's painful. You know, it's not fun to learn about that. But I wondered about, you know, when you talk about white mothers teaching their children, like that feels like it's one thing to say, okay, let's be sure to expose our kids to lots of difference, which is beautiful. And then it's another thing to also say, and we're going to learn our families' hard histories, you know, like, and we're going to take accountability for that and we're going to feel responsible for that. And we have an obligation because of that. And that is not something white people are super good at. I mean, we'll just say,
we call it in my Indigenous studies world, that is colonial guilt. Mm-hmm. And that's the number one thing that gets in the way of people actually being open to thinking and learning and taking on other people's perspectives and taking action to make, you know, to try to make the situation better for people that are still struggling with what happened in the 1800s to us is still affecting us today.
Right.
So,
Leah, we could talk to you all day. I know you have places to go, students to teach. But this is so wonderful. And just, we appreciate your time so, so much. And the work that you've done to guide and support educators, especially, you know, for Mandy and I, we'll talk a little bit about the statement that you worked on for the National Council of Social Studies to help guide people in learning about Indigenous histories and current events. That is very helpful to people who are wanting to learn and unlearn things. But just this conversation was so helpful too. Mandy, I'll pass it over to you before we say goodbye.
I think it was really, really enlightening. And I think it will be for our audience. I think just a lot of this stuff just isn't even on your radar until you get the chance to hear someone speak or, you know, to take a moment to think about it. So I hope that everybody will just take this as a moment to think of some things that we can actually start doing and don't let it be something that continues to be erased from our lives, and bring that back into our children's lives and really just make a conscious effort to do some of the education ourselves, because our society is not going to do it for us, clearly. So we're really grateful for your help with that.
Well, thank you so much for asking me to be a part of the podcast.
We appreciate
you. We'll have you back.
Yay. Well, I'll talk to you soon, Leah. Thank you so, so much. And we'll be in touch for sure.
Okay.
We appreciate you. Have a great
day. Thank you.
Talk to you soon.
Have a good day. Bye.